very Wednesday welcome to you. Hello, this is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, it is April 10th.
It is April 10th.
Which means in just 13 days, we're going to have our primary here in Pennsylvania.
We
and
are
if
indeed.
You are affiliated with a political party,
good
either
news.
Democrat or Republican, guess what? You get to vote if you are registered. If you are unaffiliated or independent, you can sleep through it, watch some Netflix because you're not part of it.
I mean, go on a walk. It's an exercise.
Go on a walk,
eat
yeah.
healthy. Yeah.
It's because Pennsylvania has a closed primary. And so today we're going to be talking about whether it's time to open the primary. There's a push to make that happen here in Pennsylvania. We'll hear the pros and the cons. We have David Thornburg, former head of the Committee of 70 here. He's very pro open primary. We'll also be talking to Seth Maskett, a political science professor out of the University of Denver. He's against it. And there's some good arguments on both sides. So we'll talk about that. We're also going to be celebrating Rosie the Riveters today.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard this piece. You put this together.
I put something together. I got to talk to two local Rosie the Riveters. Why? Well, today they will receive the Congressional Gold Medal for their contributions during World War II. It's the nation's highest civilian honor. They're our newsmaker for today. And finally, we're going to talk about some aged wine.
Aged wine. I don't know if I want to tease that anymore. Basically, the tease is that the American wine industry has its deepest roots here in Philadelphia. In fact, in Fairmount Park.
And I know you love it. This is a little tidbit that
I love tidbits.
Avi's face lit up when he's like, oh, agent, why? Where did this wine come from? So we're going to talk about that.
A little quirky history.
Yes,
I do love that.
I love it.
So give us a call on primaries and I guess old wine if you want. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. First, let's hop into some headlines briefly.
Yeah.
A piece in the Inquirer caught your eye, Cherry, and mine as well, talking about the upcoming threshold of 100 days in office.
Countdown is on.
For Mayor Sherrell Parker. I believe we're 4 days away, technically, from 100 days, day 96. And the Inky just had a nice review of what she's done, what she's still promising to do. I think the overall theme of it was TBD. There's been a big rhetoric shift under the new mayor, but as far as putting things into action, still a lot of negotiation with council going on. I was interested in what she's done on the education front. You know, I used to cover education, and everyone was wondering with this new mayor, this is the first time a mayor in a long time has been able to really shape their own school board. Mm-hmm. She retained about half of the old school board and now has nominated 5 new names. So it's kind of like a middle road, not totally remaking it, but sort of half remaking it. I found that very interesting. But there's a lot in there worth a review. Getting up on 100 days, Cherry.
I know. That happened fast. And it seems like the mayor's been everywhere doing a lot of FaceTime with different community groups. For me, what stood out is the vibe now around public safety. I mean, it seems like the folks are front and center. They're tackling issues. They're early morning press conferences, you know, the mayor is very present, you know, coming off an administration where you didn't really see the mayor very much. So she's everywhere. And so I look forward to seeing her continue to do more work. One thing that we haven't heard about, and I think you brought this up, nothing on the Sixers stadium.
Did I bring that up?
Yeah, we talked about that, like
before,
staying
away,
sort of staying away from
that.
Haven't heard a lot. A lot of pushback over how she's handling the opioid crisis. So we'll see how that shakes out in Kensington. But overall, so far, it feels like some things are getting done or things are moving. So a lot to watch. You're right. TBD.
A lot of TBD. How about NJT now? NJ Transit.
Yeah, this is also a TBD, but it looks like it might happen. New Jersey's Transit Board, they're set to vote on a 15% fare hike today. I don't know about you, but 15% seems like a lot to me.
Yep.
And for some folks, it's upping their commuting costs anywhere from $60 to $80 a month, which is why it's getting a lot of pushback. It would be the first fare hike in nearly a decade. The last time was in 2015. There had been a 9% hike. All of this, of course, Avi, is designed to make up for a $119 million budget deficit that they're dealing with. And if it passes, it would kick in on July 1st, followed by 3% increases each year beginning in 2025. One example of how the rates would change. A ticket from Princeton Junction to New York Penn Station would jump from $15 to about $18.40.
Yeah, that's real. That's a real jump for someone making that commute every day.
Every single day. Yeah. So it's a serious thing. There's going to be some protests outside of New Jersey Transit today because people don't, they feel like officials need to be focused on a more permanent solution instead of putting all the money problems on the backs of commuters.
We've talked about this with SEPTA.
Yeah.
NJ Transit, of course, not immune to the financial challenges facing public transit right now. How are you going to plug those gaps, those structural imbalances that the pandemic has accelerated? Yeah. It could be through fare increases. It could be through service cuts. And we actually have some breaking news from our producers. It looks like NJ Transit did approve that 15% hike just moments ago. Am I reading that right, producers? Thumbs up. Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Wow.
So that just came through moments ago. So
so they're going to be probably really out there today.
Yeah.
And the protest. Yeah.
And New Jersey historically, right, is a commuter state.
Yeah. People work outside of the state.
There are people who work in Philadelphia, people who work in New York and come in on public transit or on our roadways. That itself is changing, right, because more and more people work from home. So I think when New Jersey is a fascinating lens through which to view sort of the next evolution of our post-pandemic economy and how it's going to affect public life and public transportation.
Yeah, and New Jersey already gets complaints about it being expensive to live there.
Yeah.
And it's 15%. It's a lot when you add up, you know, hikes and grocery prices and other things that it just takes to live. And so, yeah, they're going to have to come up with another solution that spreads it out. How do you get more people back on trains? They claim that low ridership is part of the deficit problem. So, that 15% is going to happen July 1st.
Here's what's going to happen next. I feel a little tangent coming
on.
A little weekly tangent, and this is when I just go off on something and Cherry has no idea what I'm going to talk about.
No idea.
And as always, Cherry, I'm going to cue you up
with
some music.
Pumping circumstance.
Yes. Graduation music.
Mm-hmm.
Why was I thinking about graduation? Well, it's graduation season.
It
is coming up
pretty
soon, especially for the college kids. And I was thinking about someone I know you love and I love as well, the great Dawn Staley.
Yes.
Coach Dawn Staley from North Philadelphia,
yes,
a basketball legend and now the head coach of the University of South Carolina, just won her third national championship there.
In an undefeated season.
Killed it. Yes. We love Dawn Staley.
We do.
And she is already a legend, but her legend is only going to grow in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I am pairing her with that music because in 2022, she got an honorary degree from Temple University.
Aww.
And was the commencement speaker.
Mm-hmm.
So the rabbit hole I went down was Temple University honorary degrees. Temple, get this, has awarded more than 900 honorary degrees. Doesn't that seem like a lot?
It does. I mean, how many is that a year? They're not
that old. It's not that old. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. It just felt like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to read you some of the names. And to be fair, I don't know if all of these people actually gave addresses when they got their degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know if you would have wanted to hear this person's Temple University honorary degree acceptance address.
Okay.
So Dawn Staley, yes, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Jill Scott, 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Soul songstress Jill Scott. You want to hear that speech?
Why not?
She
sang a little bit?
Maybe.
Throw a
bar
in.
Here's another one. 2010
mm-hmm.
honorary degree recipient, Patti LaBelle.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a thumbs up for me.
Yeah, I like
Patti. I would want to.
Will she also sing a bar?
I would think so, hopefully.
And she's a big entrepreneur, too.
She is.
She
would have some wisdom
to share.
She's
great, beyond just song.
To share.
Yeah.
1986, Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be a great
speech. Legendary. That's historic. Yeah.
1986. Too bad I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
1983, Julius Irving, Dr. J.
Whoa.
That's a pretty cool one.
That is.
I don't know if I would be that interested in what he had to say, but here's an interesting
Anecdote
to go with it. The same day he got the honorary degree, He played in the NBA Finals.
What?
That's an amazing double dip, right?
That is.
All right, let's go back
they
a little
further. They have some cool people, by the way.
This is a really good list. I'm going to go through some quick. 1983, former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. I did that for our German producer, Andreas Kopes. 1980, Barbara Walters.
Wow.
1979, Cicely Tyson.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
73, Truman Capote. Interesting. 1959, Leonard Bernstein.
Wow.
The great maestro. 1955, what a year. They gave a degree to Billy Graham and Richard Nixon. That's a weird combo.
Interesting.
And let's take it all the way back. 1936, honorary Temple degree awarded to Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Now, that's a good one.
Yeah. Now, that's a speech I would like to be. All those people, you can only go to one.
Wow.
Who are you going to?
Desmond Tutu.
I think that's the one. I will close now with a quote from FDR. This is what he said to the Temple students. A true education depends upon freedom in the pursuit of truth. No group and no government can properly prescribe precisely what should constitute the body of knowledge with which true education is concerned. FDR to the Temple student body, 1936. While he was president. Pretty interesting. That is my weekly tangent, Cherry.
All right. Go Owls.
Go Owls.
Love it. So today, Avi, is a big day. Congress is honoring the women of World War II, known as Rosie the Riveter. They'll be awarded the nation's highest civilian honor, the Congressional Gold Medal. If you haven't seen the old posters or heard of the Rosies, I'll explain quickly. They were the millions of American women who joined the workforce, building ships, planes, and weapons here on the home front while the men fought overseas during the war.
It has taken decades for these heroic women to get the recognition they deserve. And the few that remain with us are in their 90s, some even over 100. Cherry, you had the pleasure of speaking with a couple of local Rosies, a 98-year-old from Levittown and a 102-year-old from Philadelphia. You also spoke with a historian about the significance of the Rosies' contributions to World War II.
They were referred to as the Hidden Army.
Many of these women came from walks of life not previously considered. The mothers, the young, the aged.
The 18 million women who filled Department of Defense and support jobs during World War II. Their nickname was Rosie the Riveter, named after the wartime propaganda that featured a muscular work shirt wearing woman named Rosie. She sported a red polka dot bandana, had her sleeve rolled up, and arm curled with a fist, her face fixed with determination. That poster was used to recruit women to take jobs once filled by men.
I've been asked, did I ever imagine that Rosie the Riveter would become such an icon? I said, we didn't do it for rewards or honors. We did it to save our country.
That's the voice of 98-year-old May Cryer. She was just 17 when she and her sister left their hometown in North Dakota to go to Seattle, Washington to work at Boeing. Her job was to put rivets on B-17 and B-29 bombers.
And they teach us how to drill holes and how to rivet and how to buck that rivet. And after 2 weeks' time, we went right into the factory building these huge bombers. And we were good. Sometimes we were much better than the men. But we didn't get the same pay as the men. The men got paid a lot more.
Even with the pay disparity, May was making her own money for the very first time.
I liked everything, and everything seemed to like me. It fit me well. And just was a role that just became natural, it seemed to me, at least it did.
But after the war, when the men came home,
they were taking their jobs back, which they deserved. But now there was no place for women. Women were going back to making beds and doing dishes. I mean, that's not very creative. And once we've been out in that working world and realize how capable we are, that's not very challenging to go back into the, like I said, the kitchen.
May got married, became a mother, and stayed home for years raising her children before eventually deciding to go back to work. And it wasn't until decades after that that she looked back and got angry.
The men came home to parades flying flags, and Rosie came home with the pink slip. It just wasn't fair that they didn't recognize what the women did during World War II. We weren't in the trenches, but we built everything that our fighting men needed. And I thought they should at least give us credit for what we did.
So May got to work. She began a letter-writing campaign in the early 1980s.
The more I thought about it, the more I wrote letters. Every decade, I'd get a little more determined.
Other Rosies joined in, and by the 2000s, their request got traction. The Rosies began doing speaking engagements and making appearances. In 2017, Congress passed a resolution marking May's birthday, March 21st, National Rosie the Riveter Day. But it took a few more years to convince Congress to award Rosie the Riveters the Congressional Medal of Honor.
To me, it's not a surprise that it's taken 79 years. And why should it take May Cryer 35 years or so to get this medal? Well, she's lobbying men.
My name is Gregory S. Cook. I'm the director of the documentary Invisible Warriors, African American Women in World War II.
Washington, capital of the United States, now the focal point of the free world tomorrow.
The interesting thing about World War II, going into the military and working in the federal government, it was really the first time in mass where black and whites were paid the same thing. So if you were a sergeant in the Army, you got paid the same thing as black, white, whatever.
Gregory Cook is a World War II historian. He says pay disparity showed up as unequal pay for women and racial discrimination and promotion and advancement for people of color. But even with the inequities, he believes the money made during the war empowered women of all races and expanded the black middle class.
They made more money than they had ever hoped to make as black people. And you had rationing during the war, so you bring home a good paycheck, but there's nothing to buy. So there's all this saving.
America would never be the same. America.
The money changed your mindset because you made almost double. So I never went back to housework.
It changed your life.
Altogether.
That's the voice of Ruth Wilson. At 102 years young, she still remembers taking a job at the Philadelphia Navy Yard 80 years ago. At the time, she was 22, married, and the mother of two young daughters.
I was a sheet metalist. We put in the bulkheads, which is the walls of the ship. You work with a mechanic.
Ruth helped to build the aircraft carrier USS Valley Forge. She showed me a photo of the finished product.
As part of the ship that I worked on, that was something.
When it was going on, did you know that what you were doing was important?
I didn't think it was that important because, you know, everybody was at war.
Ruth was one of the 600,000 African-American women who came out of the kitchens and sharecropper fields to take on more technical and sometimes skilled work. But many of them had no idea that they, too, were Rosie the Riveters.
I never heard the word Rosie in my get around.
Ruth didn't find out that the work she did was important until 14 years ago. That's when Gregory Cook found her while researching for his documentary.
I know he's pushed them other ladies, but he has really pushed me. Yeah. He said, I'm going to make you famous, and he has.
Ruth is prominently featured in Invisible Warriors. She's also the inspiration for Victory. It's a poster showcasing a mature African-American Rosie the Riveter, an 80-plus-year-old, gray-haired, yet defiant Ruth Wilson, holding up a fist with the words, "We did it," emblazoned across the bottom of the image.
That is you.
That's me.
When you see that, what goes through your mind?
I get a little chills, like.
Dream a little dream of me.
While Ruth Wilson is kind of famous, at this point, May Cryer is probably the most famous of all the Rosies. And she's easily spotted with her perfectly coiffed white hair, red bandana with white polka dots, and red lipstick smile. She is an icon. And today, she'll stand alongside 30 other Rosies to finally accept their due.
Oh, no, I'm just so proud. I'm just so proud to be one of them. I'm just one of the millions of Rosies. And I said, thank God I've had good health and been able to go out there and fight for our rights.
Wonderful. What a great story. Hey. And I love history. I love the name Rosie. Mm-hmm. And I love that piece. I could listen to that all hour.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And by the way, May Cryer says she's not done yet. She wants to see a Rosie the Riveter statue erected at the World War II Memorial in Washington. Go May. You can watch them get their medal today at 3 by logging on to WHYY.org and checking out their story.
And you can stay here with us at Studio 2 to debate the pros and cons of open primaries. Ooh. Get your thoughts in, Studio 2 at WHYY.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The Pennsylvania primary is a little less than 2 weeks away on April 23rd, but not everyone in the Commonwealth gets to vote in it. Pennsylvania has what's known as a closed primary. It means only registered Democrats or Republicans can participate. But there's now a movement to change that, with growing calls to open Pennsylvania's primary elections.
Advocates say that closed primaries aren't fair to the growing number of independent voters. Some opponents argue that opening the election isn't the political salve it's made out to be. Here with us to debate the pros and cons of our primary system are David Thornburg, the former president of the Committee of 70, who now chairs Ballot PA's campaign to open primaries. David, welcome.
Thank you, Avi.
We also have Seth Maskett, director of the Center on American Politics at the University of Denver. Welcome, Seth.
Thank you for having me on.
And listeners, share your thoughts. Would opening primaries to all voters strengthen our democracy? If you're an independent, how do you feel about all of this? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
So, David, we wanted to start with the pro-opening primaries argument to lay the foundation. How do the closed primaries work currently in Pennsylvania, and why do you say it needs to change?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Let me start out with a basic fact. We're one of seven states that hasn't figured out a way to allow independents into that part of the election process. So I would say we're different, and that's bad. Really for two reasons, and Avi mentioned one of them. There's a question of fairness. We have 1.2 million voters who pay taxes to support these elections who get shut out. A disproportionate number of them are young voters, and that seems like a bad idea, and a disproportionate number of them are veterans, and that seems like a bad idea. The second thing is, you know, just the basic math. If we bring more people into primary elections, we create more competition, we force candidates to talk to more voters early on, and that sounds to me like a recipe for better government when those folks end up in Harrisburg or Washington or county seats.
David, what type of open primary do you think Pennsylvania should have? Because there are a lot of variations on the theme here.
Yeah. You know, they say, politics is the art of the possible.
Right.
So this is kind of a baby step. Technically, it's called a semi-closed primaries because you would still have a Democratic primary and Republican primary. But in this case, we would allow independent voters to choose which primary in which to participate. And I'll point out, this is a very similar to what Colorado enacted in 2016 by a vote of the electorate.
So if you're independent, unaffiliated, you would choose. If you're a Democrat, could you cross over and vote Republican? Not in your proposal.
Nope.
Okay.
No, and that's a critical piece. This is not a free-for-all. It's not everybody vote for everything.
Yeah. Just curious, though, personally, I know this is what you're spearheading here is this particular proposal. Do you think there's a step beyond that that you'd like to see Pennsylvania get to eventually?
Well, if you look around the country, there's an incredible amount of ferment around the way we carry out elections, this interest in ranked choice voting and totally nonpartisan primaries. But for the time being, I count that in Pennsylvania as kind of beer talk.
Okay.
It's fun to talk about, but we have this right in front of us that I think we can get done, and I think it will. Not going to solve all problems for all time, but going to be a significant step forward.
And a quick follow-up, what has been the challenge getting it passed? I mean, there's been talk about this for more than a year at this point. Yeah,
I mean, file it under resistance to change. Mm-hmm. That's really what it is. No one can really remember. I mean, we made this change in 1937 in a very different world. And I would defy
the
anybody.
The current primary system.
That's right. Yeah. I would defy anybody to justify what we have today based on what we did in 1937.
And, well, I guess we'll bring in Seth Maskett then.
Yeah, exactly, Seth. Come on in to the conversation. You argue that primaries should be closed. Lay out your position.
Well, I mean, the main issue for me, and I appreciate what David said, there is a really wide range of these different systems across the United States. I think a lot of the way we conceptualize primaries is often incorrect. Primaries were founded and are a way for a party to pick its nominees. That's the main purpose they serve. And they're only just one of several ways to do it. There are also states that do caucuses. Traditionally, there are party conventions. So primaries are a way for a party to pick who it wants as its nominees in the general election. It's a decision made by a party where they decide on who should represent the party, what the party should stand for, and who they think can get elected. And it's really an internal party decision. I think in many ways it's improper for people who are not interested in being a member of that party to be affecting and in some ways determining, you know, who that party ultimately picks as its nominee.
So following that line of logic, Seth, would it be then proper for a party in a specific state to just go back to the way it used to be, where the party leaders kind of got into a room somewhere or had a nominating convention and voters writ large weren't involved at all? If you're saying it's up to the party to decide how this should go, would that be proper to sort of go back to the old system?
You know, there's definitely some who are pushing for that. And I think there's some ways that that could work. The problem with that is that you know, that is the way that parties often used to pick nominees 100, 150 years ago. And I think today there is just much more of an expectation in some form of democracy. And that if a party just, you know, if it was just decided by a handful of people in a smoke-filled room, that would widely be regarded as, you know, as in a sense, an illegitimate choice, that a lot of people would simply reject that choice out of hand. And we've seen that issue really in both parties in recent years, when there's concerns that, you know, decisions were being made by insiders, you know, people that can sort of undermine support for the party's nominees. So I think it's useful and important for building strength behind a nominee for party voters, party rank and file members to be involved with this decision. That doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be open to essentially everyone who wants to participate.
So, Seth, you recently watched Colorado go. You're at the University of Denver. You watched Colorado go from a closed primary to a form of open primaries. What was your observation about this? This allowed independents to choose which party they wanted to participate, which party, you know, election they wanted to participate in. What's your critique of that?
You know, it's been interesting watching Colorado over the last few decades. Yeah, it used to be a closed primary system, sometimes with some elements of caucuses built into it. It's really been a state that's experimented a lot in recent years. The way the elections, the way that primaries work here today is that we have an all vote by mail system. So everyone who's a registered voter receives a ballot at their home about 3 weeks before the election. And if you are unaffiliated, if you're registered as an unaffiliated voter with either of the parties, you receive both the Democratic and Republican ballots in the mail, and it's up to you which one you want to fill out and send back in. I was actually surprised, you know, I was concerned that was going to create a lot of voter confusion and a lot of people would send back both parties' ballots, which would have spoiled them. That has actually not been a real problem. People have been, I think, pretty capable of making a choice on that and learning how to follow the rules. And there honestly is a lot of participation by unaffiliated voters. The unaffiliated choice is you know, far outpaces the number of Democrats and Republicans in the state here. But again, you have a situation where there, you know, a lot of these choices are being made by people outside the parties. We've actually seen a lot of pushback from Colorado's Republican Party, which is looking for ways to try and opt out of this system because they don't like the fact that a lot of their nominees are being picked by unaffiliated voters.
Go ahead, David.
Well, by the way, I mean, I looked at this. The law in Colorado actually allows a party to revert to a caucus system or pick them out of a hat system or whatever if they get a sufficient supermajority in their own party. So there is sort of a relief valve. But, you know, my comment on that whole question is, if the parties want to own the process and do whatever they want to choose their candidates, terrific. A, don't ask us to pay for it.
Right,
then.
It's taxpayer funded.
It's about $75 million a year, yeah. So it's not chump change. And B, I think if there's something fundamentally almost un-American about conscripting people into a party against their will simply to allow them to exercise their vote.
I want to read in some comments. And by the way, if you want to add yours on whether a primary should be open or closed, studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. Paul says, Pennsylvania should adopt open primaries. It's crucial that individuals can choose candidates they believe genuinely represent their interests, irrespective of party lines. This inclusive approach has the potential to foster greater cooperation among elected officials and enhance voter engagement. That's Paul's take. However, you read some political scientists who say open primaries just don't do that. I mean, it seems like they would do that in theories, but they don't produce more moderate candidates. They don't even really change the composition of the electorate all that much. Here's a political scientist, Seth Hill, UC San Diego. The overall ideological composition of primary electorates does not vary much by participation rules. I mean, David, would this have any impact?
Well, look, I did my time in academia. I can find a half dozen professors say one thing and a half dozen professors say the other thing. Here's what strikes me. I'm just going to focus on Pennsylvania because that's what I know best. If you look at the last two presidential races, the independent voters, people who identify themselves as independent, swung those two elections. In 2016, Donald Trump had an 7-point advantage among those voters. And in 2020, Joe Biden had an 8-point advantage. So there's a 15-point swing. That strikes me as a clear statement that independent voters represent kind of a changeable vote, a swing mm-hmm. vote, if mm-hmm. you will. And I think in this day and age, when we've got these calcified political parties digging into their trenches, that feels like a good thing.
It would seem to me that the parties would want independents to participate by opening the primaries because it would allow them to see who they could sway, right? I mean, are there arguments for parties to want this to be open? And Seth and David, I wonder what those are, like would they want this?
Well, we're trying our best to make them, and I will give Seth a minute. But, you know, I would say for the Republican Party, and I'll just focus on Battleground 2024,
yeah,
you need to convince the less extreme members of your own party and the less extreme members of the independents that you've got a base still left in the middle. For the Democratic Party, I think you've got to convince this growing number. By the way, this is the fastest growing segment in Pennsylvania. Growing number of young voters, veterans, Asian Americans, Indian Americans who tend to be more independent, that you want them in the party. So I think there's a good political argument for both teams.
And Seth, what have you seen in Colorado? Has it been beneficial for parties to actually have independents weigh in at the primary stage?
It's difficult to say. And honestly, when we're talking about independents, we're talking about a pretty large and diverse, ideologically diverse group of people. A lot of times when people say that they call themselves an independent or say that they're unaffiliated between either of the major parties, that often includes a lot of people who lean Democratic and almost always vote Democratic, or lean or almost always vote Republican and just prefer not to call themselves a Democrat or a Republican. The actual percentage of people who are truly independent, who like truly swing back and forth between the parties, is fairly small. We're talking about like roughly 10% of the electorate. And David is right. Those folks are really determinative of, they have a big influence on what goes on in general elections, in November elections. That doesn't necessarily mean that they should or even are particularly interested in participating in the primaries. And honestly, if they are, it's not that hard to join a party. You know, unlike a lot of other democracies where if you want to participate in nominations, you have to pay dues, you have to attend meetings. There's not much of a burden for people to actually register as a Democrat or a Republican. It's often fairly easy to switch back after the election if you don't want to. Yeah. But it involves just a little bit of a commitment to a party to participate in its
quick
nomination.
Response there.
Oh, I'm going to say, I'm going to go old school here. Mm-hmm. I used to believe, I was Republican most of my life, that joining a party ought to be sincere. And someone said, if you change parties just to take advantage of the upcoming election, it's kind of like choosing your religion based on the upcoming holidays. Right? Like that Hanukkah thing. That seems pretty cool. I'll be Jewish. Or I want to celebrate Easter, so I'll be Christian, you know? So I would question that.
Right. Okay. I want to read in a comment from another David. A different David here says, I think they should get rid of all primaries. Yeah. They are a political crutch and just give free advertising to the political parties, making it harder for third parties to have a fair chance. Interesting. I'll let that just sit out there. But Seth, I want to ask you, if the research suggests that the impact of open or closed primaries depends on the type of race, and I'll ask it this way. Would an open slash closed primary matter more in, say, a city like Philadelphia that's heavily Democratic versus a state like Pennsylvania where it's far more of a mixed electorate? Like, we're talking about impact here, and I just wonder if the type of race matters.
So for the most part, the answer is no. I was involved with some research a few years ago with a number of other scholars where we looked at the state legislative level. So not just in Pennsylvania, but around the country, looking to see whether state legislators who were nominated through closed primaries behaved and ran differently than those who were nominated through open primaries and a wide range of primaries in between. And the answer was really no. We weren't able to find such differences. There might be a few differences from in places that do systems like California or Washington has in their top two kind of blanket primary system.
And explain that real quick for people who don't know.
So in California and in Washington and a handful of other places, essentially you have it's not even properly called a primary. They have essentially like a first round election where everyone can run against everyone else for that office, regardless of party. And the top two vote getters, even if they're of the same party, go to a runoff election in November. And so that creates a situation where you have like a Democrat versus a Democrat in a number of congressional districts in California. And what sometimes happens is the more moderate Democrat wins in those situations. We do see like at least a slight effect from nomination systems like that. But for the most part, whether it's open or closed, really doesn't make much of a difference.
Very interesting. Teresa, I want to read this comment. Teresa has emailed, the League of Women Voters of Pennsylvania has been advocating for open primaries for quite some time. The League believes all voters need a say in primaries. And during our office hours today on Instagram, we had Shirley who said she just had to join a party. She had to just join because she wanted to participate in a place like Philadelphia that's heavily Democrat, where otherwise you don't participate. And so we only have about a minute and a half or so. I want you to talk about, what are the chances of this actually happening? You guys are going to be rallying.
Yeah, we have a big rally tonight. Tomorrow night out in Fort Washington at McGurk's Pub. The unprimary. It's the primary for those folks.
I like
folks
a rally at a pub, by the way. That's
seriously
a good idea.
Look, I see this, that the tide has been coming in for literally almost 30 years. There are bills in the legislature going back 30 years. It's coming in every time a little further up the beach. And I think because of the politics right now and the competition in Pennsylvania, the presidential, all our legislators in the House are up, that this may be the year that we can get it done.
It's mostly pushed by Democrats, though. Will there be bipartisan support?
There is bipartisan support. These are bipartisan bills in both the House and Senate. So for different, it's one of those classic things. For different reasons, both Republicans and Democrats can stand up for this. We just need more, and we need more push.
Well, there you have it. That was the voice of David Thornburg, who chairs Ballot PA's open primary campaign. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Avi.
And we also heard from Seth Maskett, director of the Center on American Politics at the University of Denver. Seth, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
So I guess we could see change.
We might.
We'll be looking.
We might.
Coming up next on Studio 2, Avi, we're going to talk about 300 plus year old wine. And efforts to revitalize the old grapes from Fairmount Park.
The what? The what?
Some old grapes.
Okay. That's coming up on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Welcome, everybody, to Shea Studio 2.
Ooh!
We have an extensive wine list for your dining pleasure. Mm. Today, our featured red is bold and historically rich.
Mm.
It originates in the fertile Fairmount Park wine-growing region, and because of its Quaker roots, this grape often pairs best with silent, prayerful contemplation, as well as chicken. Would you like a try, ma'am?
Why, of course. Let me put my pinky up and sip this. It tastes old. Perhaps as old as 1740?
You have an excellent palate, ma'am.
Yes, and if I'm not mistaken, what you've just described, Avi, is the Alexander grape, first discovered here in Philadelphia and later grown across the colonies. It's the subject of an event today held by the Penn Museum, exploring our city's surprisingly robust wine history. Chantel White will be there. She is the archaeobotanical teaching specialist at the Penn Museum. Chantel White, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so let's talk about this wine history of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So my understanding, Chantel, is that this goes all the way back to William Penn.
Mm.
How was William Penn involved in wine?
Sure. William Penn established a vineyard in what's today known as Lemon Hill, all the way back in 1683. And he hired a well-known and well-respected Huguenot winemaker to make this wine and to take care of all of his vines.
Someone from France.
Yes.
Sort of brought over. And, yes. And how did it go?
It went terribly. As it did for all early North American vineyards.
Okay.
And the reason why is because along with the winemaker coming from France, all the vines came from France too.
Mm.
And every single one of those European grapevines failed within 2 to 3 years of being planted here in North America. And that's because they weren't disease resistant to things like phylloxera and black rot. So within 2 to 3 years, they all died.
All but right. Not a great job by Billy
but
Penn.
But there was some good luck that happened.
Yeah.
And some a little bit of mixing. There, and a new plant, a new type of grape came out of it. Tell us about the Alexander grape.
Sure. So from those early grapevines, even though they only lived for maybe 2 or 3 years, some of them did actually flower, right? So they did pollinate some of the other grapevines, including wild grapevines that were also growing just naturally at Lemon Hill around the Schuylkill. And when those wild grapevines got pollinated, it created a hybrid between this old world grape and this grape from the Americas, and that was the Alexander grape. So it's completely natural the way it occurred. And this was in 1740. It was first discovered by a gardener who was walking around the area, and he was the gardener at Springettsbury, which was Penn's estate. And so he's the one that then brought this Alexander hybrid into production.
He just sees this thing growing and says, this looks cool.
Yeah,
let
he
me
noticed.
Trim it. Yeah.
So he could tell that the grapes were a little bit shaped differently than a wild grape. He could see that there was maybe like a little bit of old world grape involved. And then also the taste was different. It had sort of an old world taste to it a little bit. And he could also see that the flowers were perfect flowers, which means they had both male and female portions of them, and that's only found in old world grapes. So he knew he had found something very interesting.
Good job, Gardener Alexander.
Go ahead, discovered that. And so how did that change the wine industry here in this region at the time?
Well, it did sort of slowly and in a really sort of, I don't know, mysterious way, because nobody was quite sure what to make of the Alexander grape because it had both characteristics of North American wild grapes and characteristics of Old World wine grapes. So people kind of like called it what they wanted to call it. So there was a vineyard that was created up near Conshohocken by a man named Peter Legault in the late 1700s. He may or may not have known that it was a North American hybrid, but he marketed it as a grape from South Africa.
Oh.
And that was what survived in his vineyard. So he called it the Cape grape. But it was actually the Alexander grape. He just maybe refused to admit that.
So the question is whether he didn't know or whether he lied.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We still don't know.
Yeah.
But that was the one thing that survived out of his vineyard. Out of the hundreds of thousands of grapevines he planted, the Alexander grape survived.
And this, I mean, am I understanding it correctly? This is basically the original sort of at least half American wine grape. Like this proliferated a bit from there?
Yeah. Yeah, so this becomes the, because it's the only thing that will grow,
yeah.
Right?
In this it vineyard. Survives.
Yeah, exactly. It survives. I mean, its fruit is described as not bad.
But that doesn't sound good, though.
I think really some Europeans still feel unpleasant. That way about American wine, yeah. By the way.
Because yeah. It has this muskiness to it, right? Yeah. This foxiness to it that we think of with Concord grape juice or even like the grapiness of grape candy, right? So it wasn't something that a European palate. Yeah. You know, was a fan of.
And so this is, because I've been on Lemon Hill. I didn't know that grapes mm-hmm. had grown there at some point. Mm-hmm. Why didn't Philly become, is that why Philly didn't become a grape capital?
Yeah. There were other hybrids that could also survive that were developed in the 1800s. And so because the Alexander grape, you know, didn't have this completely amazing taste. I think it was gradually replaced by other hybrids.
So for a time, though, people were legit drinking this Alexander grape wine.
Yes, it was the predominant wine in North America. Yeah.
Wow.
The not bad wine.
Yeah.
The not bad wine. Not bad. And so I guess
but not good.
You basically just explained it there. But so because other varietals emerged that were better than not bad, Philly never took off as like sort of the wine capital of North America.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
but now there's this effort to bring the Alexander grape back. Well, if it's just not bad, why? Why bring it back?
Because it's cool, Terry.
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah, first it's cool.
I'm sorry.
But second of all, I mean, we didn't set out to carry out this research just to find an amazing wine, right?
Okay.
It's such an interesting part of Philly's history that we were just sort of curious to see whether or not it might still exist.
Mm.
You know, there are vineyards and winemakers who argue that they do still have the Alexander grape, but we're not sure. And so we were like, why don't we go to Lemon Hill and actually see if any of these hybrids still exist in the wild grapevines that are growing around there today? So we took cuttings, myself and Andrew Wraith, who's a grad student at Penn, and Bartram's Garden is now growing these cuttings to see if we might actually have perfect flowers and evidence of hybrids from Lemon Hill. Yeah.
Right. So the stage that we're at now is we don't quite know.
Right. This is a completely ongoing research project
wow.
that we just began this past fall.
So when will we know whether we've got the real thing here?
We will know in 2 to 3 years whether we've got a hybrid, right? But whether it's actually the Alexander grape, we're going to have to go digging into historical herbaria and actually see if we can find old vines that have been preserved.
See how interesting this is?
That is interesting. So you've never actually tasted the Alexander grape?
No, no one has.
So no one has for however many hundreds of years at this point.
I want to
taste this musky wine now.
Right. It might taste a little bit like Welch's.
Yeah, right. It might taste a little bit like grape candy. Yeah.
Oh, my. I am praying for your success. It's still a cool project regardless
wine,
of whether it works or not. But I am so praying for your success.
Thanks.
Because I want to taste this thing so bad. I want to drink William Penn's weird mutant wine.
And I'm glad to know it's not just preserved in just this old wine. That it's going to be new.
But it might not be.
And so you guys are going to have an event. It's sold out. Mm-hmm. And so what's going to be happening there?
So I'm going to be giving a lecture along with Eli Sillins from Communa Cellars. And he's going to be talking about modern wine making and his efforts to increase the consumption of North American hybrids. And I'm going to be talking about the history of the Alexander grape.
I love it.
Chantel White, archaeobotanical teaching specialist at the Penn Museum. We so enjoyed your time today.
Thank you very much.
Archaeobotanical teaching. I love that title.
I want that
title too.
You haven't earned it, but I do want it.
It's so cool. And that wraps up our show today. Cheers. Yay! Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered the show today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk to you tomorrow.
Bottle reds, bottle whites, every kind of mood you're in tonight. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian.